A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about something that doesn't quite add up on the surface. Israel is famous for sending search and rescue teams to disaster zones worldwide. Earthquakes in Turkey, Haiti, Nepal, Mexico. But the skill set required for digging through rubble for days on end is methodical, slow, sustained. The opposite of the speed-driven counterterrorism response Israel is also known for. His question is basically, how did Israel become a pioneer in this specific form of emergency aid? What's the origin story of that expertise, and how is it developed and offered? And the coal puzzle. Given Israel's deep experience with terrorism, why has it become associated with painstaking post-earthquake search and rescue, which seems like a completely different capability?
It's a great question, and the short answer is that the terrorism experience didn't create the SAR capability. It created a foundation of adjacent instincts that were then deliberately built into something else entirely. The real origin story starts with a wedding.
The Versailles Hall.
The Versailles Wedding Hall collapse, 1995. 23 people died. The building's floor gave way during a wedding reception, a pancake collapse, which is exactly what it sounds like, one floor dropping onto the next. And Israel's emergency response that night exposed serious gaps. They didn't have a dedicated urban search and rescue unit. Firefighters and soldiers did what they could, but there was no specialized team trained for exactly this scenario, shoring up unstable voids, cutting through reinforced concrete in a way that doesn't bring the rest of the building down on the people you're trying to reach.
So the catalyst was domestic. Not a terror attack, not an earthquake, a building failure at a wedding.
Right. And that's the first thing most people get wrong about this story. They assume Israel's SAR expertise grew out of responding to bus bombings and building attacks during the Second Intifada. But the formal capability was stood up before that wave of violence. The Home Front Command, Pikud Haaretz, was created in 1992, partly in response to the Gulf War Scud missile attacks that showed how unprepared Israeli civilians were. Then the Search and Rescue Brigade was formally established in 1996, the year after Versailles. The Intifada didn't start until 2000.
So the timeline runs the other way. The institution was built, and then the terror wave gave it more experience. Not the other way around.
And the institutional architecture matters here. The SAR Brigade is a reserve unit. Most of its members are civilians with day jobs. Structural engineers, architects, medics, construction foremen. People who spend their regular workdays thinking about how buildings stand up and how they fall down. When they deploy, they're not soldiers doing soldier things. They're engineers with military logistics backing them.
That's a structural choice that keeps costs low and expertise high. You're not paying a standing army of SAR specialists to sit around waiting for earthquakes.
Right, and it also means the skill pool refreshes itself. The guy who spent the last 3 years designing apartment buildings in Tel Aviv brings that knowledge into the rubble pile. The medic who works in a hospital emergency room every day brings that. You're drawing on the civilian economy's expertise and layering military discipline and logistics on top of it.
But a reserve model also means these people have to train regularly. You can't just hand a structural engineer a cutting saw and say, good luck.
No. And this is where the training infrastructure gets interesting. The IDF maintains a dedicated SAR training facility with simulated rubble piles, collapsed buildings built specifically for teams to practice on. They can simulate different collapse patterns, pancake collapses, lean-to collapses, V-shaped voids, and they train with international partners. The unit is certified by INSERAG, the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group, which operates under the UN. Israel was one of the first countries to achieve what's called heavy classification.
Heavy classification means what exactly?
It means the team can deploy as a fully self-sufficient unit with structural engineers, canine search teams, medical personnel, and heavy cutting and lifting equipment. They bring their own tents, food, water, fuel, everything they need for 7 to 10 days. The principle is that an international SAR team should never become a burden on the country they're trying to help. You show up, you set up your base of operations, you work, and you leave without drawing on local resources that are already stretched.
That self-sufficiency requirement is a huge logistical lift. You're essentially deploying a small village.
And it's one of the things Israeli teams are known for getting right. The 2010 Haiti earthquake, Israel set up a field hospital that treated over 1,100 patients. They were one of the first international teams on the ground with a fully functioning surgical capability. That's not just search and rescue anymore, that's a broader medical deployment, but it runs on the same self-sufficiency model.
Let me pull us back to the terrorism question, because I think Daniel's instinct is right, even if the direct lineage isn't there. The skill sets feel different. Counter-terrorism is about speed. Neutralize the threat. Extract casualties fast. Secure the perimeter. Earthquakes are is about patience. You're listening for tapping sounds, cutting carefully, shoring up voids, working in 12-hour shifts for days. They're almost opposite operational philosophies.
They are, but there's one area of genuine overlap, and it's building collapse caused by attacks. During the Second Intifada, there were suicide bombings that partially collapsed structures. Not full pancake collapses like Versailles, but enough structural damage that you needed to extract victims from unstable buildings. That created a pool of personnel, military and civilian, who had real-world experience with the basics, reading a damaged structure, identifying void spaces, cutting and breaching without causing secondary collapse. The terrorism experience didn't create the SAR capability, but it created an operational need and a cohort of people who understood the problem.
So the terrorism experience was the shallow end of the pool. It gave people a feel for the water, but then the country deliberately built an Olympic swimming facility on top of it.
The deliberate part matters. This wasn't an accidental byproduct. Israel made a strategic choice to invest in this niche.
Which brings us to the why. Because building a world-class SARA capability is expensive, even with a reserve model. Training facilities, equipment, international certification, deployment logistics. Someone had to decide this was worth the money.
Three reasons. The first is diplomatic soft power. Israel is a country that faces a lot of diplomatic isolation. UN resolutions, boycotts, strained relations with many countries. Humanitarian aid is one of the few forms of engagement that's almost universally welcomed. When an Israeli SAR team pulls survivors out of the rubble in Turkey or Nepal, that generates goodwill that no diplomatic cable can match. The 1999 Turkey earthquake was the first major international deployment, and it opened channels between the two countries that had been cold for years. The 2023 Turkey-Syria earthquake. Israel deployed despite having no diplomatic relations with Turkey at the time. The team went in, did the work, and left.
That deployment was notable because relations were basically frozen, and yet the SAR team still went.
And Turkey accepted them. That's the power of this particular form of aid. It's hard to politicize a team of engineers pulling your citizens out of collapsed buildings. The optics are terrible if you refuse.
Second reason.
Military readiness. The Homefront Command has a dual mission. Protect Israeli civilians during war, and provide international humanitarian aid. The same equipment, the same training, the same command structures serve both purposes. Working under pressure in unstable environments, coordinating multi-agency responses, operating in austere conditions, these are directly transferable to military operations, especially urban warfare and homefront defense. Every international deployment is also a training exercise for the scenarios the unit would face if Israeli cities came under attack.
So the humanitarian mission and the defense mission are feeding each other. You deploy to Haiti, you learn things that apply to a missile strike on Tel Aviv.
And the third reason is that this is a niche a small country can actually excel at. Israel doesn't have the budget to compete with USAID on post-disaster logistics or shelter management or public health interventions. But urban search and rescue, finding and extracting people from collapsed structures, is a high-visibility, high-impact, relatively narrow capability. You don't need a massive aid budget. You need a few dozen highly trained people, good equipment, and the logistical ability to get them there fast.
It's the boutique approach to humanitarian aid.
And it works. Israel's niche is specifically USAR, Urban Search and Rescue. the teams aren't running refugee camps or coordinating food distribution. They're the people who show up with dogs and listening devices and concrete saws, find survivors in the first 72 hours, and extract them. That's the whole mission.
Let's talk about what that actually looks like on the ground. A deployment. Walk me through it.
An earthquake hits. The Foreign Ministry and the IDF make a joint decision to deploy, usually within hours. The team is on standby and can be airborne within 12 to 24 hours. They fly in with their own equipment, set up a base camp, and coordinate with the host country and other international teams through the INSERAG coordination framework. The first priority is always search, K-9 teams and acoustic listening devices to locate survivors. Then you move to breaching and shoring, cutting access holes, stabilizing voids so rescuers can enter safely. Medical teams are embedded throughout, and you're working in shifts around the clock because the survival window closes fast.
The 72-hour window.
Roughly. After about 72 hours, survival rates drop sharply, but it's not a hard cutoff. In Haiti, Israeli teams pulled people out after 5-6 days. There's a famous case of a man extracted after something like 8 days. The window depends on injuries, access to air and water, temperature. But the first 3 days are the sprint.
And the team is working in a collapsed building the whole time. The thing could shift.
Which is why the shoring is so critical. Before anyone goes into a void, you're installing timber or pneumatic struts to stabilize the structure. Every cut you make changes the load distribution. You need structural engineers on site making calculations in real time. This isn't a job for generalists.
So the reserve model makes even more sense in that light. You need the guy who spent 10 years designing buildings, not a 22-year-old conscript.
And that's the hidden genius of it, but also the fragility. Let me flag something I think is under-discussed. These reservists are in high demand in their civilian lives. Senior structural engineers, experienced physicians. They're not easy to pull away from their jobs for 2 weeks of training plus potential deployments, and there's a physical component. After a certain age, crawling through rubble in full gear stops being viable, so you have a retention problem. The institutional memory walks out the door when people age out.
That feels like the kind of problem that doesn't show up in the glossy deployment photos, but matters enormously over time.
It does, and it connects to a bigger question about scalability, which I think we should come back to. But first I want to mention one more thing about the training, because there's a detail I love. The IDF training facility, the rubble simulation area, has a specific structure nicknamed the wedding cake.
After Versailles.
It's a 3-story stack that simulates a pancake collapse. They literally built the thing that killed 23 people into their training infrastructure so that every new recruit understands exactly what that failure mode looks and feels like. That's not just training. That's institutional memory made physical.
That's also a very Israeli approach to trauma. You don't build a memorial. You build a training simulator and make sure it never happens again.
And you deploy that knowledge globally. The 1999 Turkey earthquake was the first major test. Israel sent a team of about 250 people, one of the largest international contingents. They operated for about a week, pulled 12 survivors from the rubble, and set up a field hospital. The diplomatic impact was immediate. Turkish-Israeli relations had been cooling, and this deployment basically reset the conversation. It demonstrated that Israel could offer something valuable that wasn't military or political.
And the model has been refined since then. Haiti 2010, Nepal 2015, Mexico 2017, Turkey again in 2023.
Each deployment teaches something new. Haiti was a logistics nightmare. The port was destroyed, the airport was overwhelmed. Teams that couldn't be fully self-sufficient struggled. The Israeli team had its own surgical capability and didn't need to rely on local hospitals that had collapsed. Nepal was a high-altitude deployment with different challenges. Thinner air, harder to move, heavy equipment. Mexico 2007 was an urban earthquake in a dense city, which is a different search problem than a rural disaster zone.
Each one is a slightly different flavor of the same problem.
And each one feeds back into the training curriculum. The unit does after-action reviews, updates procedures, modifies equipment. It's a learning organization, not a static one.
There's something I want to name here that I think is easy to miss. When we talk about Israel's SAR capability, we're really talking about a very specific thing. Urban search and rescue in collapsed structures. Not flood response, not wildfire response, not pandemic response. It's narrow.
And that narrowness is a feature, not a bug. A small country can't be excellent at everything, but it can be world-class at one thing. Israel picked collapsed structure USSR because it had a domestic catalyst, Versailles, and because the skills overlap with military needs, and because it's the kind of high-drama, high-visibility aid that generates the most diplomatic return per dollar spent.
The cynic's read is that this is aid as PR.
It's partly aid as PR. I don't think that's a secret. MASHAV, Israel's Agency for International Development Cooperation, coordinates these deployments alongside the IDF, and their mandate explicitly includes development diplomacy. But here's the thing. The aid is real. People get pulled out of rubble who would have died otherwise. The field hospital in Haiti treated real patients. The motivations can be mixed, and the outcomes can still be good.
Mixed motivations are sort of the default setting for international aid. Everyone's doing it partly for soft power. The question is whether the capability is real.
And it is. The INSAROG heavy classification isn't a participation trophy. It's a rigorous certification process. The team has to demonstrate proficiency across something like 15 different capability areas: search, rescue, medical, logistics, command and control. They get reevaluated periodically. If standards slip, the classification gets downgraded.
There's an external accountability mechanism. It's not just Israel saying it's good.
Right. And the international SAR community is relatively small and tight-knit. Teams from different countries train together, deploy together, and evaluate each other. Reputation matters. If an Israeli team showed up unprepared or caused problems, word would spread fast.
Let me circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the fragility of the reserve model. You said institutional memory walks out the door. How serious is that?
I think it's the single biggest long-term risk to the capability. The unit depends on a relatively small pool of highly skilled people, maybe a few hundred core personnel. If you lose a cohort of senior engineers who've done 3 or 4 international deployments, you're not replacing that experience quickly. The training can simulate rubble piles, but it can't simulate the chaos of a real disaster zone. The coordination problems, the local politics, the emotional weight of pulling bodies out for days.
The physical demands mean people age out.
Mid-40s is probably the upper end for the most physically demanding roles. Some people transition to command or planning positions, but you still lose the hands-on expertise. It's a pyramid with a narrow top.
Which connects to Daniel's question about how the expertise is developed and offered. The answer is, through a deliberate institutional structure that works well, but has a built-in expiration date on its human capital.
That's not unique to Israel. Every country's SAR capability faces similar challenges. But Israel's reserve model makes it more acute, because you're not dealing with career SAR professionals who do this for 25 years. You're dealing with civilians who do this as a second job.
What's the fix? Professionalize the unit.
That would be enormously expensive and would lose the civilian expertise that makes the reserve model valuable in the first place. A full-time SAR soldier doesn't spend their week designing buildings or working in an ER. The trade-off is real. I'm not sure there's an easy fix. I think it's more about managing the transition between cohorts carefully, making sure knowledge gets transferred before people leave.
This feels like the right moment to bring in someone who actually knows something about this from the inside.
The wedding cake.
Go on.
The training block they call the wedding cake. I argued with a military engineer for 3 days about whether to build it with reinforced concrete or unreinforced masonry blocks. He wanted realism. Full reinforced slabs, exactly what collapsed at Versailles. I wanted blocks that wouldn't kill a trainee if something shifted during an exercise. We compromised. The bottom two layers are reinforced. The top layer is block. That way, if it goes, it's not 3 stories of concrete coming down on someone's head.
You worked on the training facility.
Early 2000s. I was doing structural engineering, mostly commercial buildings. The IDF put out a tender for consulting on the rubble simulation area. My firm got a piece of it. I spent about 4 months on site, mostly arguing about load calculations and failure pattern. The military engineers knew exactly what they wanted to simulate. They had photos from Versailles, from Turkey, from a building collapse in India. They'd studied every major pancake collapse they could find, and they wanted the training piles to replicate the specific void patterns.
The training isn't generic rubble. It's engineered to reproduce specific failure pattern.
Every pile has a purpose. The wedding cake simulates a floor-by-floor pancake. There's another one that simulates a lean-to, where one wall holds and the floor slab tilts, creating a triangular void. There's a V-shaped collapse simulator. They can also flood sections to simulate working in water, or run smoke through to simulate low visibility. It's a very deliberate piece of engineering.
The nickname, the wedding cake, that came from Versailles directly.
Everyone knew what happened there. Some of the early trainers had been at the original collapse. They wanted every recruit to know what they were training for. The name stuck.
You mentioned the argument about safety versus realism. How did that tension play out more broadly?
It's the fundamental tension in all of this. You want training to be hard enough that people are ready for the real thing. But if you kill someone in training, you've defeated the purpose. The compromise was always, make it look and feel real, but build in hidden safeties. The blocks in the wedding cake's top layer are mortared in a specific pattern, so they'll crack along predictable lines if they shift. The heavy cutting exercises use concrete that's been pre-scored in ways the trainees can't see. It's theater, but it's theater that saves lives.
That's fascinating. It connects to something we were just discussing, the institutional knowledge problem. How much of the design knowledge from when you worked on the facility is still there?
Some of it's documented, some of it walked out the door. I left in 2004. The lead military engineer on the project retired about 5 years later. I doubt anyone currently training there knows why the wedding cake's top layer uses a different mortar mix than the bottom two. They just know it works.
That's exactly the fragility Herman was describing.
It's worse than you think. The reserve model means the trainers rotate too. You might have a brilliant instructor who did 3 international deployments and really understands void search. And then he turns 43, his knees give out, and he's back to designing shopping malls full-time. The guy who replaces him read the manual but didn't crawl through the rubble in Haiti.
What would you change if you could?
I'd pay a small number of senior people to stay on as career instructors past the point where they can physically deploy. Keep the institutional memory in the training pipeline even after the knees go. Some of that happens informally, old-timers consulting, but it's not systematized. When I was there, the knowledge transfer was basically, Bob showed Steve how to do it before he left. Bob was good, but Bob's not a system.
If Bob gets hit by a bus, the knowledge is gone.
Bob did get hit by a bus. Not literally. He moved to Australia. Same effect.
The wedding cake detail is going to stick with me. A domestic tragedy, literally built into the training infrastructure, and 20 years later the people training on it don't know why the mortar mix is different.
That's most institutions, honestly. They're built on decisions someone made for good reasons, and after a while nobody remembers the reasons. They just follow the procedure. Sometimes the procedure is still good. Sometimes the original reason doesn't apply anymore, and nobody noticed.
The other thing I'm taking from this is that the capability looks solid from the outside, but is more contingent than it appears. It depends on a small number of people, a set of training facilities that embody knowledge that's partly lost, and a reserve model that burns through human capital.
Yet it keeps working. Deployment after deployment, the teams perform. So either the fragility is overstated, or the system has informal mechanisms for regenerating knowledge that we're not capturing.
Probably both. The thing about a small country is that networks are tight. The guy who trained you might be your neighbor. You run into him at the grocery store and talk shop for 10 minutes. That's not a system, but it's not nothing either.
It's the informal knowledge economy of a small place.
I still have the original load calculations for the wedding cake in a box somewhere. Nobody's ever asked for them.
Of course you do.
The misconception that most people hold about this topic is that Israel's search and rescue expertise is a natural extension of its counterterrorism experience, that the same skills that respond to bus bombings just transfer over to earthquake rubble. The reality is that the capability was deliberately built from a domestic building collapse, institutionalized through the home front command and a reserve model that draws on civilian engineering and medical expertise and certified to international standards before the major wave of terror attacks even began. The terrorism connection is real, but indirect. It created some adjacent experience and operational need, but the SAR capability itself was a separate, intentional project.
The question I keep coming back to is scalability. As climate change increases the frequency and severity of natural disasters, the demand for international SAR teams is going to grow. The reserve model works for a small country with occasional deployments. But what if the tempo picks up? 3 major earthquakes in a year instead of 1 every few years. Does the model hold, or does the human capital burn faster than it can be replaced?
That's the open question. And it's not just an Israeli question. Every country with a SAR capability is going to face some version of it. But Israel's model, because it's so dependent on a small pool of reserve personnel, may hit the wall sooner than most.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing, and for the load calculations that are apparently still in a box.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.